Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a multifaceted war. It has many vectors now of threats and dangers, opportunities as well. A woman who has been monitoring and engaged in helping us understand and to a very considerable degree shaping our responses to these sorts of challenges over the past 30 years, particularly as they relate to America's interests in the Middle East, is our guest for what I am very pleased to say is a full and very special hour-long report with Shoshana Bryan. She is today the Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center and the editor of the JPC's In Focus magazine, but she brings to this an incredible wealth of experience, notably with other organizations and advisory boards and positions involving informal consultations, at the very least, with senior members of our legislature and executive branch over those decades. And she is a woman that I admire greatly and am thrilled to have a chance to talk with at length. Shoshana, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you, Frank. It's very nice to be here again.
I think what we want to talk about mostly, though we will have a far-ranging conversation dealing with a number of the challenges that currently are evident in the Middle East, but let's start with one that seems overarching and, frankly, connected to most of the others, and that is the so-called Islamic Republic of Iran. It's mostly been in the news of late, of course, for the administration's efforts to negotiate some kind of deal with it with respect to its nuclear program, but has explicitly left out almost everything else about Iran and its conduct in the Middle East and beyond these days. Give us a sense of what the Iranian regime is up to at the moment and whether it's appropriate to be focusing so narrowly on one piece of its, well, misconduct.
To start with the end of your question, Frank, no, it's not appropriate to be focusing only on one part of Iran's behavior. Iran is the source of all evil in the region. I know that sounds like a huge statement.
There seem to be so many other contenders for that distinction.
If you scratch the surface of each of those other contenders, you find Iran playing there. Iran's goals are not only to have nuclear weapons, certainly they want those, but they want to be the regional superpower, perhaps the world superpower, but for the moment they'll settle for the region. So if you look at Syria or Yemen or some of the problems that Israel has, problems that Egypt has in the Sinai with smuggling and terrorist organizations, you will find Iran and Iran's money behind all of it. So no, it's wrong to say, well, the Iranians want nuclear weapons, and if we can prevent that for 10 years, which is the president's position, that's a good thing. It may be a good thing, but it may also be an irrelevant thing as they march through the rest of the region, sowing mayhem.
That is, of course, assuming you actually could prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon sometime in the next 10 years. And I know you've looked at this matter of the nuclear program as well. And let's just deal with that and move on to the rest of your sort of indictment here, Shoshana. But is there, in fact, based on what we know today and what we're seeing in terms of the negotiations going forward with the Iranians, any reason to believe we would actually realistically expect to see a 10-year hiatus in their nuclear ambitions?
I'm not sure it's realistic to think that you have a 10-minute hiatus. It is not clear that they don't already have a nuclear capability. Everything we know about Iran's nuclear program, we've discovered after the fact and on the side. So they may have them now. Certainly, if they continue to progress in the areas that we know they're progressing along, they will have one whenever they want one. The question isn't, can they wait 10 years? The question is, why would they wait 10 years?
Right. Especially since the deal as it is shaping up now seemingly leaving essentially all of the infrastructure they need in place to obtain that nuclear weapon means it's basically just a matter of when they choose to proceed rather than actually having to acquire additional capabilities. And Shoshana, again, just before we leave the nuclear component of this, what does this region look like? Taking your point that there's an awful lot of other bad things that the Iranians are up to that cause their neighbors grave concern. But what does this neighborhood look like if these kinds of threats to the Saudis, to the Gulf states more generally, to Israel, to Europe, to us for that matter, but just sticking with the region for a moment, what does it look like should the Iranians actually realize their nuclear weapons ambition?
It looks like a nuclear arms race, because the Saudis will not permit the Iranians to have nuclear weapons and themselves not to have nuclear weapons. And you can buy the components and you can buy the technique and you can buy the expertise, and the Saudis have plenty of money. If the Saudis have a nuclear weapon, I suspect the Egyptians will want a nuclear weapon. The Turks will want a nuclear weapon. Everybody will want a nuclear weapon. And the technology and the capability exists.
It may not just be a single nuclear weapon, of course. I know you're using that sort of as a catch-all. The problem may be as well, again, as you know so well, Shoshana Bryan, that you don't have to fool around with buying these things in piece parts or getting expertise and so on. You may just be able to buy them off the shelf fully ready to go from the North Koreans, the Pakistanis, perhaps others. And there is some evidence that the Saudis are now making clear that is their intention. All right, we've set the stage here. Iran has regional, at least, ambitions, is pursuing aggressively and seems increasingly likely to be unchecked in pursuing those nuclear weapons ambitions. If there is a cascading proliferation in the region, one of the things that I've been concerned about is not only that countries that sponsor terrorism or that are themselves engaged in jihadism of various kinds would then become nuclear weapons, in addition, of course, to Iran, but most of those countries you've mentioned are at risk of being beset by turmoil internally, perhaps resulting in absolutely bona fide terrorists coming to power instead of the present regimes. Again, what would it mean if the region is actually not only awash with nuclear weapons, but in the hands of overtly declared enemies of this country who we designate as terrorists? Now, sitting in positions of power as rulers of these countries?
Well, then you would have issues with, for example, oil. The United States is not beholden to the Persian Gulf anymore for oil. We don't need the Saudis. We don't need the Iranians. But there's a very large world out there comprised of friends of ours who do. And so if you have, what should we call them, radical governments who are not amenable to the world order that
maybe we should call them more radical governments.
More radical governments. Well, Syria is a perfect case in point. Do you want cancer? Or do you want heart disease? Do you want Assad or do you want ISIS? Neither case is good for us. But what you have is the possibility of upheaval in the oil markets. For the United States, let me just point to one small particular point. Yemen sits across the Gulf from Djibouti. Djibouti is where AFRICOM has major resources, major assets. That's how we watch not only the Persian Gulf, but we watch Africa that way. And Africa is hugely important to the future security of the world. Do you want Iran sitting 45 miles from AFRICOM? So these things play out in many different ways in terms of energy, in terms of security, in terms of just people who go out to not like us and try to figure out ways that they can undermine our interests and our efforts and our allies. The governments they have are bad enough. The governments they will have will be terrible.
We're going to have to pause here in a moment with our guest, Shoshana Bryan. But when we come back, Shoshana, I think I want to pick up right on the point that you've just mentioned, which is a facet of an Iranian hegemonic role in the region that could have profound implications for the world energy supplies and in economic conditions if the Iranians find themselves able not only to restrict what oil is coming out of the Persian Gulf, but also all of that that flows through to other parts of the world, the Red Sea and the Suez Canal and so on. Events that seem now increasingly in prospect. Shoshana Bryan is our guest. She is today the senior director of the Jewish Policy Center and the editor of its In Focus magazine. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for a special edition of Secure Freedom Radio with one of the people that I've come to regard as truly a savant about matters involving the Middle East. She is Shoshana Bryan. She brings more than 30 years of experience in the analysis of U.S. defense policy and Middle East affairs. Now working as the senior director of a wonderful organization, the Jewish Policy Center. She finds time somehow to also edit its In Focus magazine, really required reading in Washington. Shoshana, you've set the stage very well with respect to Iran, the folly of sort of trying to compartmentalize the various things that are ominous about it, including this question of its larger hegemonic ambitions. Maybe we could just drill down for a moment on something you touched on there at the end, and that is the Iranians clearly are seeking to establish control of a very strategically located country, Yemen. Talk a little bit more about what they might be able to do should they succeed through their proxies, the Houthis, to restrict oil flows and what that might mean through two of the world's principal sea lane arteries.
The free flow of oil and the free flow of economics is the cornerstone of what we would call the Western way of life. You have to have it. You have to have energy. Iran sits on the Persian Gulf. Yemen, for those who can't visualize a map, sits in the boot of Saudi Arabia on the Red Sea. As you say, those are two major transit points for energy. Right now, we're in a little bit of a lull. Energy is not terribly expensive. The Saudis have been doing their best to keep the price down, hoping to drive their adversaries into bankruptcy. But it will
Which
go
include
up
a lot of American fracking companies, the last time I checked.
I don't think they meant to do that, but that, yes, that is the effect.
We're visiting with Shoshana Bryan of the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Shoshana, we were talking a little bit about how if circumstances change from sort of this lull, as you put it, how very ominous Iranian control of these key waterways, the Red Sea on the one hand, the Persian Gulf's exit point, Strait of Hormuz, on the other. Finish your thought there.
Okay, my thought is our Asian allies plus China, China not being an ally, import more than half of their oil from the Persian Gulf. Some of those countries, Korea, South Korea, and Japan, import up to 75% of their oil from the Persian Gulf. The president is at the moment trying to negotiate a new trade pact with Asian countries. If oil rises to a point where those countries go into recession or depression, there's no point in having a trade pact. We will have major economic difficulties in various parts of the world. That, I would suggest to you, will drive the Chinese to even more aggressive behavior in the South China Sea and elsewhere. So this is a linchpin. This is a centerpiece for a lot of other policies that the United States has to pursue in different ways. Energy is the linchpin of economic development around the world, and the Persian Gulf is a primary source. We need it. They have it.
Yeah, your point is that if the rest of the world catches cold, we may get pneumonia as well, to play with a metaphor that's been around for a long time. What if you saw the Saudis, who are now actually waging war against these Houthis, unable to prevail, and this problem in the south of their country metastasizes across their border, perhaps combined with Iranian operations, or for that matter, those of the Islamic State, and we'll talk about them more in a moment. And we saw real internal instability inside Saudi Arabia. Would that be sufficient to trigger the kinds of conditions that you're talking about?
Yes, I think so. Saudi Arabia is still the master at oil and oil prices, which is why they remain in the trough at the moment. It's the Saudi desire to have them there. The Saudis are sitting on so much cash that they can afford negative cash flow for the time being, and that's what they're prepared to sacrifice for long-term control of the market.
And in the past week, we saw the Saudis exhibiting, shall we say, their displeasure with President Obama. As I understand it, the new Saudi King Salman not only turned down at the last moment an invitation to come to Washington for a summit to meet with the president with five other Gulf Cooperation Council leaders, but went to the horse races in Britain instead. I don't know if that's so, but it certainly seems to capture the current state of U.S.-Saudi relations. Give us a flavor of what it means that we are, at this point, seemingly alienating so profoundly countries that have in the past at least been important to our security interests in that region, even though I think they've been playing a pretty bad double game against us in other places as well.
Well, they play a double and a triple, and it was the King of Bahrain who went to the horse races, not the King of Saudi Arabia. But your point is absolutely an essential point. The United States has alienated Saudi Arabia, with which we have been allied since the late 1940s, and specifically since the British left the region in the early 1960s. We want the free flow of oil. The Saudis agreed to give it. In exchange for that, we didn't look at a lot of other things the Saudis and the Gulf states did. We ignored other behaviors. But the deal on oil and the free flow of oil, with the exception of the 1974 Arab oil embargo, has been a pretty solid deal. President Obama has changed the parameters of the deal. He doesn't want to look only at Saudi Arabia as his partner in the region. In fact, he doesn't look at them at all as his partner. He's looking to Iran.
Is it fair to say, and it seems to me this is not unique to this part of the world, needless to say, but that we've really switched sides?
Yes. Yes, I think we have switched sides. But it's not clear who we turned away from and who we turned to. Yes, we've turned away to some extent from Saudi Arabia, and yes, we've turned toward Iran. But that's a very small piece. In the bigger piece, are we for ISIS or are we for Assad? I think we're not for either one. We end up being more on Assad's side than ISIS's side, but that doesn't help us in the rest of the region. So there are lots of different ways to play who's for whom. And we haven't even looked at Africa yet.
Yeah, and perhaps we can talk about that before we're done. But just staying with this region, as you said at the outset, Shoshana Bryan at the Jewish Policy Center, so many of these things have ties into Iran. There would be no Assad regime today were it not for the support that Bashar Assad enjoys from the Iranians, and notably their proxy army, Hezbollah. Similarly, what we've seen developing in Iraq, in the past at least, has been Iranian collaboration with the Islamic State, now waging war against it. We seem to be providing air support for the Iranian operations, the Shiite militia and so on. Try to, if you would, give us a short course on what is happening with respect to Iranian hegemonic ambitions in both Syria and Iraq at the moment.
The short course is they're winning. In Baghdad, nothing is done without agreement with the Iranians. And in Damascus, nothing is done without the agreement of the Iranians. So even though on the battlefield, the Iranians, by the way, do not look very good at the moment on the Syrian battlefield. Okay, they're having a lot of trouble. The Assad regime is having trouble. Hezbollah is having trouble. Couldn't happen to nicer people. But in general, politically, you have four capitals now in which Iran is holding sway, which is Sana'a in Yemen, Tehran in Iran, of course, and Damascus, and Baghdad. So in terms of regional hegemony, the Iranians are responsible for lots of things in lots of places that we used to consider independent countries, and they're no longer independent.
And there is this overlay, and you sort of alluded to this, of the Shiite-Sunni dimension, and we'll come back with that and more. Dialogue with Shoshana Bryan of the Jewish Policy Center right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined for this full hour with one of the country's, I think, go-to people when it comes to making sense of the incredible, complex, and increasingly turbulent part of the world we call the Middle East. It really is quite an extensive space, and few people understand it better than our guest, Shoshana Bryan. She is today the Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center and the editor of its In Focus magazine. But she brings a wealth of experience to the subject, going back literally three decades, and truly is a national treasure. And I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you at length, Shoshana. Thank you for your time. We were discussing several pieces of what is currently roiling the Middle East at the moment. There is a strain of academic and, policymaking belief about the region that focuses very substantially on the fault line between Muslims of the Sunni strain and those of the Shiite persuasion. Notably, the latter are dominated by the Iranians and their friends. They are a minority in the region, but increasingly, with the rise of Iran, a force to be reckoned with. How do you see that playing out in the kinds of challenges we're facing in places like Syria and Iraq and Yemen and perhaps beyond?
Well, there is a Sunni-Shia divide, but it's not as neat as people would like to think it is. The Iranians will support Sunnis if it moves them toward their larger goal. For example, Hamas in the Gaza Strip is a Sunni organization. Palestinians are generally Sunni Muslims. Iran is the major funder of Hamas. In Africa, which we're not going to spend a lot of time on, I understand that, but in Africa, most of the Muslims are Sunnis, and yet they are getting enormous amounts of Iranian money. In Iraq, you have Iran supporting Shiite militias who fight with Sunni army members to fight against Sunni ISIS. It's very complicated in Iraq, and it does not split neatly along Sunni-Shia lines. So although there is a fundamental, no pun, division between Sunnis and Shiites, the Iranians blur those lines all the time.
You know, this is such an important point, and it is mostly overlooked. I kind of think of it that they are, you know, sort of hardwired to default to killing each other. But you're absolutely right that their faith tradition and their strategic instincts run to killing infidels jointly wherever possible, and then they'll sort things out amongst each other in due course. And, you know, notably, though, as you say, Shoshana, it's gotten very little attention. The federal judge actually ruled that the Iranians were the prime movers behind the 9/11 attacks perpetrated by Sunnis out of principally Saudi Arabia. So this point is very well taken, and you're right. It does confuse, to say the least, the situation in a place like Iraq. But let me move to another part of the region that I know is near and dear to your heart as it is to mine, Shoshana Bryan, and that is the part of the Middle East, I guess known as the Levant, specifically the Jewish state in the midst of all of these hostile nations, Israel. What is it that we're seeing at the moment as a result in part of the cancer and the heart attack, as you say, or heart disease in Syria, in part because of what the Iranians have been doing for decades in Lebanon, in part because of the relationship between the Iranians and Hamas, in part because of what's been developing, as you've indicated, in the Sinai, to say nothing of Jordan and Egypt? But what is the current strategic status or condition of Israel in all of this?
The current strategic status is not bad. Israel drew red lines, and when they draw red lines, they mean lines, unlike the President of the United States on occasion, which have served them very well in the north, both on the Lebanese border and the Syrian border. Those are the places that they worry about the most. But secondly, it's had the effect of producing alliances that Israel had not thought were possible. They may be temporary alliances, I suspect they are, at least the Saudi-Israel relationship, which has become very, very good and tight. I think it's temporary, but for now it works. Israel, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, they've all discovered that the enemy of my enemy could be my friend, might be my friend, sometimes will be my friend. Israel and Egypt are now very, very tight. They exchange intelligence information. The Jordanians and the Israelis always had done that, but there is more of it now. The Israelis have taken a very, very hard line on their own borders, and happily for them, they've discovered people on the other side of some of those borders who agree with them.
This is, I think, a glass-half-full, glass-half-empty kind of proposition, and I suspect you would agree with that. You've certainly indicated that it can change over time, and notably, as we discussed earlier, Shoshana, if any of these governments were to fall, especially the Jordanians or the Saudis or, heavens knows, the Egyptians again, all bets are off for Israel. But looking at it from the somewhat half-empty sort of consideration, when you see the Iranians and Hezbollah now operating, it appears, in close proximity to the Golan Heights, for example, or Hezbollah tunneling aggressively under the northern border, or Hamas once again getting back into the tunneling business out of Gaza, is your analysis something of a snapshot in time, but that the trends may be very ominous indeed?
Yes, it is indeed a snapshot. The trends are not good. And this is why the Prime Minister of Israel said, which upset the President of the United States, that he did not foresee a Palestinian state during his administration. He didn't mean, I think, never ever under any circumstances. But this is a moment during which Israel should take care of its borders and take care of itself and do a little bit of serious security fence building, not in the physical sense, but in the security sense. And this would be exactly the wrong time to announce that the Palestinian state, which will have an army should it come into existence, is okay. It's not okay. It's not okay. Israel is not in a position to take any risks at the moment. Everything is tenuous. Everything is shaky. Everything is scary. This morning, it looks all right. Tomorrow afternoon, it may not.
Yeah. Shoshana Bryan, again, that perspective, both short-term, near-focused, and longer-term is one of the things I prize about your expertise. Let me just ask you, and we'll perhaps come back in the last block to the question of the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians, to the extent one could even dignify it with that term. You've touched on something that is clearly also contributing to what makes me worry about Israel's strategic situation, namely the profound hostility of the Obama administration, starting with the president, for the Jewish state. And I don't care how many speeches the president makes at AIPAC in which he tries to paper this over. I think anybody with any acumen at all understands that he is undermining them at every turn, and his hostility towards Bibi Netanyahu isn't just personal, it's that, but it also, I think, has to do with his real feelings towards the Jewish state itself. What would you say about the state of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and how is that factoring into Israel's strategic situation, as you see it?
Well, the good news is the Pentagon has been a bulwark of support for Israel, long-term, short-term, current-term, everybody's term. That's very good news. Those things continue as they should continue. The White House is a different story. The president appears to have come to office with the idea that your enemies should become your friends. It's true with China. It's true with Russia. It's true with Iran. It's true with the Palestinian Authority. It's true everywhere. Cuba. So you see the president trying to bring into the fold countries that have not been friendly to the United States. It's not a very successful thought, because when you do that, the people who are already in the fold get very nervous. And the more nervous the Israelis become, the less likely they are to take what the president would ask them to do, which is risks for peace. It's a silly phrase to begin with. But the more you frighten people, the more you hold out the specter that their enemies are going to sit at the table with them while they're still enemies. We're not talking about reformed Iranians or reformed Palestinians or reformed Cubans or Chinese. We're talking about in their current hostile state, and you're expected to give them something.
They may be sitting at the table instead of our friends, which is another subject which we'll come to in our last block with the wonderful Shoshana Bryan, on the so-called peace process and where we're likely to see these kinds of side-switching by the Obama administration leaving American security interests, including yours, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. Alas, it is for our final segment of this very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio with the marvelous Shoshana Bryan of the Jewish Policy Center. She is its senior director, also the editor of its In Focus magazine. Shoshana, you've, again, set a rich table for us. There's so much more to talk about, but maybe we could just, while we're talking about tables, much is made still of the Obama administration. It is truly, I think it was Santayana's term about fanaticism, having, you know, redoubling the effort when you've lost sight of the objective. The administration is badgering, coercing, and otherwise trying to intimidate Israel into making further concessions, taking risks for peace, as you say, including with the threat, really the blackmail, of not supporting Israel at the United Nations, where many states, including most recently, I guess, the Vatican, have decided they're going to recognize the so-called Palestinian state. What is up with what the Obama administration is doing, and what might the implications be if they persist?
Well, it's straight-up blackmail. If you don't do this, we will do that. There's no other way to say it. It's blackmail. And it's blackmail in a place that Israel finds itself fairly vulnerable because a lot of money flows through the UN system. Most people think that the problem of the UN is the pronouncements that it makes. The pronouncement of Palestinian statehood itself was irrelevant, whether it's the Vatican or anybody else. What counts at the UN is the flow of money. And with each of these resolutions, the UN sets up commissions and committees and other mechanisms for distributing money. And if you take away Israel's protection at the UN, even more money will flow into those Palestinian pots. And you know that they're not doing anything constructive with them. So the problem for Israel at the UN is that they're being blackmailed by the only country, well, the second only country, that would ever protect them. The other one is Canada, and Canada doesn't have a veto in the Security Council.
And Shoshana, when you talk about the flow of money, one of the places, and again, I think most Americans haven't a clue about this, enormous amounts of money flow is to the UN's Relief and Welfare Agency, an organization that is for the exclusive benefit of the Palestinians. Talk a little bit about what its operations entail and how it's kind of a prime example of this phenomenon you're talking about that goes beyond just the rhetoric at the UN.
Well, the agency that you refer to, which is called UNRWA, was set up in 1950 to handle the resettlement of Palestinians who claim to have been dispossessed in 1948. It should have been a short-term problem. The UN High Commission on Refugees, which is the other UN body that does this work, has settled millions and millions of refugees. But UNRWA's mandate was changed, actually, from the beginning, to say it would resettle them when there was peace between Israel and its neighbors. Now, as you know, that's probably a long way off. So over the years, UNRWA has become a social service agency to millions of Palestinians who have not been permitted to resettle anywhere. It's the only refugee population in the world that grows instead of declining. If your grandparents came to the United States as refugees, your parents were not and you are not. But among the Palestinians, refugee status goes from father to son to grandson. The need for money then becomes endless. More refugees need more money.
And you sort of perpetuate this festering sore by not actually wrapping this thing up, and presumably that's very much the reason for its continued existence.
Not only perpetuate, it expands.
It really festers. Shoshana Bryan, one of the things, again, that I value so much about the perspective that you bring to this is your capacity to sort of connect the dots and make sense of them. One of the other phenomena in the Middle East at the moment, and that speaks to a point that you've kind of touched on several times now, which is This isn't about Israel. This isn't about the peace process with Israel or the lack of a peace process with Israel. This is about far bigger and very malevolent forces at work. You've, I think, persuasively made the case that Iran is at the lead of that list. Describe as well in that regard what is happening to Christians in the region and how that really bears out this point that it isn't all about Israel.
At the current rate, there will be no Christians soon. Christians have been decimated across the region, starting with Iraq, in which you had millions of Christians who have been there from the time of the Bible, and you can find very few of them there. There is a small community left, but they have been subject not only to ISIS massacres, which are in the news, but prior to that, terrible, terrible discrimination in the Middle East, in Iraq. Christians in Egypt under the Muslim Brotherhood, Coptic Christians, were under great pressure, much less so under al-Sisi. In fact, al-Sisi went to a Coptic church on New Year's Day. People missed this. And he talked about the need for Egypt to be for all Egyptians. It's a huge statement. But elsewhere in the region, except in Israel, the Christian population is declining rapidly and under brutal circumstances.
And that includes, of course, in Syria, which under Assad had actually treated them relatively well, I think it's fair to say.
It's horrible to have to admit this, but Saddam was good for the Christians and Assad was good for the Christians because both of them wanted to run a secular state and didn't want any of that religion in the way. So they ended up protecting, by default, they ended up protecting Christians.
But no more. And as you say, this is a region that is soon to be presumably not only free of all Christians, but if the jihadists, the Sunni or Shiite, have their way of Jews as well. Which brings us to really the money question, I guess, Shoshana Bryan, against this very, very worrying tapestry of problems in the region, the various threat vectors and bad actors and lack of American leadership and having our friends being treated worse than our enemies and all that that portends. What would you do at this point, if you were able to actually, you know, determine U.S. policy, not just for a day, but going forward?
Well, since we know that throwing up our hands and crawling in a hole doesn't work, I would look to a country like Australia, which did a very interesting thing. You can no longer leave Australia, join ISIS, and come back to Australia. They won't let you in. Once you leave, you're gone. And what that really speaks to is the ability to set bottom lines for your own country, and it helps to set bottom lines for other countries. The United States has to find the wherewithal inside of itself to say this far and no farther. What do I have to protect? Who do I have to protect? How do I have to protect them? And if you can't find that quality inside of yourself in your own country, you're in big trouble. I would say one of the things that drives Secretary of State Kerry nuts is that Israel has bottom lines. Israel has lines beyond which it will not go. Kerry doesn't have any. The United States, at the moment, doesn't seem to have any. So the beginning of wisdom here is to look at what it is that you find unacceptable and not let that happen. If it means you have to go to war, then you have to go to war.
And maybe in closing, just one of those very pronounced bottom lines for Benjamin Netanyahu has been, there will not be a nuclear weapon in Iran. Given what you've said, and what I fear you're very correct in saying, is an imminent nuclear weapons capability, if actually they don't already have some number of these, what do you anticipate will be the policy of the government of Israel?
I think when push and shove come together, Benny Gantz, who just retired recently as chief of staff of the IDF, said that Israel's responsibility is to the Jewish people, past, present, and future. It's interesting that you have a responsibility to the people who are already gone, but that's the legacy that you have to deal with. And I think the Israelis take that so seriously that you will find, to the best of their ability, Iran will have no bomb. You can draw conclusions from that any way you like.
Well, I pray that they will have the wherewithal to assure that state, because I believe it is not only in their interest but ours. And I pray as well that we will assist them in ensuring that that is the right outcome, and that we as a people, as a free world, will be spared the consequences of failing to address this real and present danger of Iran, which, as you said at the beginning, is kind of the leitmotif of so many other challenges in this strategically important and yet very, very dangerous part of the world. Shoshana Bryan, as always, thank you for the tremendous work you do at the Jewish Policy Center, and we're all much admiring of your In Focus magazine. I hope that we will have a chance to visit with you again soon, but I particularly appreciate you taking this much time to visit with us at length. We'll talk with you soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.